Hi, and welcome to the Hollywood Dreammaker Podcast. I'm your host, Billy Gallo. I'm a 35-year veteran actor. I'm the kid who came out to Hollywood with $200 in my pocket and a one-way ticket when I was 18. Didn't know a soul out here, and I've been living my dream ever since. I've had an amazing career. I've been an Academy Award-winning film, blockbuster film, hit TV series. You name it, I've done it, and I got the IMDb credits to prove it. 6 years ago, I opened up my own school, the Manhattan Actor Studio, where I found my true passion. That's teaching the craft of acting, but not only teaching the craft of being the guy. Success leaves clues. I know how to make dreams a reality. I did it for myself, and I do it on a daily basis for my students. And I can help you achieve yours. Welcome to my podcast. Let's get started. I am super excited to introduce my guest. He's a seasoned actor with an impressive resume spanning theater, television, and film. His dedication to his craft has propelled him to success, earning him recognition for his versatility and his commitment to his roles. He's starring in the upcoming Richard Linklater film, Hitman, opposite Glenn Powell. I want to welcome the talented Mike Markoff to the podcast. Welcome to the show, brother.
Thanks, Billy. So happy to be here, man.
It's good to see you, man.
Yeah. It's funny because you and I kind of, in a way, had an unscheduled podcast somewhere off the coast of Italy where we met. Yeah,
that's right. That's why I had you on the show because, I was in Italy for Christmas and New Year's, and I was meeting with my friend Bobby Maresco, who was on the podcast. He was my second guest on this podcast, and you're my 100th guest. So
wow.
It's pretty awesome to come, hit that 100 mark. So I was sitting with Bobby and we were talking and he was at the Capri Hollywood Film Festival. You were sitting across from us and he introduced us and we started talking and we had a great conversation about acting and the craft. And I was like, this is somebody I want to have on the podcast. I mean, you over there, you were getting an award. Didn't you get an award in Capri?
Yeah, they're giving me one of those, which is always kind of fun and not often the experience of getting to dress up and feeling relatively important. I consider myself pretty blue collar in the trenches in the acting game most of the time. It's usually just long hours and being cold and driving myself absolutely crazy. So it was nice to, have a little break and be in somewhere cool and somebody give you a little recognition for all the hard work you put in. That was super cool. And Bobby was the one who handed me my award, which is obviously an incredible honor. So.
Yeah, Bobby's awesome. I love Bobby. I've been friends with Bobby I was a member of his actors gym. I still am for, 28 years or something like that. I mean, we've done a couple of films together. We've done a play in Chicago. I mean, we've been around the block together.
Oh, so that's really cool. I'm so curious. Chicago's my hometown. I got started in the Chicago theater scene. Where'd you guys put a play up at?
So, it was a one-man show. It was based on Donnie Brasco.
Oh, cool.
So Joe Pistone was, with Bobby and they created this. It's called Way of the Wise Guy. It's based on the book that they made Donnie Brasco. And it was a one man show and it was a kind of a multimedia show. So my friend Leo Rossi played Donnie Brasco and I played Sonny Black, the role that Michael Madsen played. So all of my stuff was film, but he's on stage and I would pop up on the big screen and we'd interact with each other. So I wasn't there in Chicago. It was a multimedia kind of thing.
Gotcha.
But,
cool.
But it was in Chicago. So yeah, let's go back. I'd love to go to the beginning. When did you know, right, you wanted to be an actor?
I was one of those little kids that was having a lot of trouble being good at things. My dad put me in baseball every year and it was just strikeouts and left field and everything. And it wasn't until my temple put on a musical. I auditioned and I got in just because I'm like 8 years old. I don't really have much else to do. And this seems really fun. And yeah, everything just kind of came alive right then and there. And I realized that my place was, meant to be on stage. Yeah. And then from there on, continued doing theater, joined a theater company, traveling theater company when I was about 13. And that's when things kind of got like serious where, after doing like Fiddler on the Roof in school a couple times and a couple other things, when you come from a North Shore kind of Jewish suburbs, you end up doing Fiddler on the Roof a lot. And I was a fat kid back then, so I always played the butcher. I joined this theater company called Reality Theater. So it was just performing constantly. It was this little theater company that made up of teenagers that wrote and produced their own material and performed them at schools and theaters around the Chicagoland area. And that's when I discovered improv and started studying improv pretty intensely around 13 or 14, because we generated material that way often. Sometimes we would workshop it by acting it out. Sometimes we would talk it out. And then I was in a very competitive theater high school. That really kind of prepared me to, I guess, in a small way for what life was going to be like as an actor, which is a lot of nerves and a lot of intense competition and everything. And then I booked my first movie when I was 16. It's a horror film. It was the first film audition I ever gone to. I think I had like Googled it because I just wanted to be in a movie. I just didn't really know how. I didn't have your podcast to listen to. I didn't know anything about agents or anything. But auditions, do you find on the internet? You find low budget horror films. So that's what I did for my first movie. And it was amazing. It's filled with horror icons. Like Joe Estevez, Robert Zadar, and Linnea Quigley, who would have worked with you on Night of the Demons.
Yeah, Linnea was in it. That's awesome.
She was in it. And then, and I just kind of went from there. And
did you get your SAG card on that?
No, I got my SAG card on a military industrial a year later that I didn't even know was SAG until I got something in the mail. And then the focus went pretty earnestly back into improv and theater and the Chicago kind of scene with that. Moved out to LA a little young. I'd done some training at a BFA program in Illinois and then also at a conservatory program in downtown Chicago where we had, it was this really cool conservatory called Act One, kind of set up like a grad school kind of style way of learning where it's sort of 8 hours a day of all this crazy method acting. Chicago's a big, gritty kind of mixture of Meisner and First Folio Shakespeare, which are opposite ends of the spectrum. Right. You have one that seeks to kind of follow the language and stick to the language. And the language is the methodology in and of itself that will guide you. And then there's Meisner and Strasberg with this dive headfirst into these emotional circumstances, make them your own, tie your own life into it and get raw and get crazy. And you didn't get an A in the class until you were, on the fetal position on the ground, crying, having been molested. Just kidding. No, but seriously, that was generally a part of the circumstance. And then I went to study at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater under Larry Yando, who's an expert in the First Folio technique, which really changed everything for me, I think, at the end of the day, which is to sort of speak quickly about it. Shakespeare, because oftentimes he didn't have the ability to direct his actors or the time, or because the actors didn't get the other actors' words, just the cue lines, he had a certain way of writing and spelling the language as a means to direct the actor. For example, if you had a line that had 5 one-syllable words in a row, it meant that you were supposed to speak it slow, bold, and deliberately, like, go home now. Or if he would misspell words like black, if it had an E on the end of it, it meant that you were supposed to emphasize it. Like, you wouldn't say black, then you would say black, or something like that. So it was I had a very contrasting kind of style of upbringing. Could sort of say it was like the Chicago cocktail, I think is what I would call it.
That's awesome. You know, I mean, I tell my actors all the time, you want to learn everything. Learn Meisner, learn every Strasberg, learn everything, and then create your own method. Figure out what works for you. What's in your actor toolbox? What do you have? I mean, I teach method acting. I am a method actor. You know, I believe don't act. Just what do you got? Who does the character become because you're playing this character? What part of your soul can you leave behind on that stage or on that screen? You know, it's really about being naked, bearing your soul.
100% agree with you. And it's like you say, it's like there's a lot of ways up that mountain and there's no one recipe. It's an incredibly intangible art form. When I think back on whether it was high stakes auditions or really intense sets, and I think about what did I use? What did I have to rely on that held me completely steadfast? If I'm being honest, technically, none of that would have been my training. When I really look back on it, it's however it is that you decided to train your instinct, because it's your instincts. When you're on hour 13 and you are wet and you are cold and the DP and the director aren't getting along and it's causing tension on set, and you have another actor you're working with who's being difficult. We all know that when we're outside of class and we're there on the ground, boots on the ground, you don't know what's going to happen. Things get crazy. And in those moments, what you realize is you are relying on you. I always tell people, it's like, train yourself, become a human being that can withstand and be in the moment and make incredible choices and have the instincts kick in when you are listening to give you a little bit of the opportunity for that magic to happen, because we're comfy and watching a movie and eating popcorn and watching something on screen. The people going through it up on that TV there, you know what the circumstances look. We all hope that we have optimal acting conditions. We never have optimal acting conditions, really, right? So you have the opportunity to, you know, when you're in class, to really flesh out all the different aspects of you and your art and everything. And it's like my old acting coach used to say, like, when you go into that audition, when you go on set, all that preparation, yeah, let that live inside of you, but throw it away, mm-hmm. throw it away. And hopefully your preparation has woven themselves into your instincts. And when they say action on the 39th take and you're cold and tired and on a night shoot or something, hopefully you're ready.
Absolutely. You know, I teach my actors to train the beast, you know, the gladiator, the warrior that shows up in those moments, you know, and that starts with an early morning routine, you know, waking the beast up and letting yourself know who you are. Maybe taking a cold ass shower and waking up and affirming who you are in that cold ass shower and shutting down the noise and training yourself, because acting on set is just a bunch of distractions. I mean, you got a hair person, you got makeup, you got wardrobe, you got the sound guy, you got the script supervisor coming over to you, changing a line, you got the DP. I mean, it's just distractions. So you have to be able to be grounded and go into your own little zone. Like you said, you may be working on another actor that's, you know, you have to play, I love this person, but you can't stand this person. You met him in makeup up and they're freaking asshole, and you gotta figure out, how do I substitute? How do I personalize? How do I put somebody real in there? How do I shut down the noise when we're losing the light and we're, you know, working, you know, at the 14th hour and we got to get the shot off and it's stress city? So it's really about training that muscle so you can breathe and you can ground yourself and you can put yourself in that little cocoon where not, you know, I mean, you're a method. I think you're a method actor, right? I mean, like me, I don't sit around craft services eating friggin' donuts. You know, I'm over there in my corner over there, you know, waiting for, you know, I don't care who you are. I mean, I've done movies with Julia Roberts and I just didn't say a word to her on set because my character was her pimp, didn't like her, you know, or Danny Trejo, you know, we worked, you know, hello, I met him in, you know, the table read. But after that, I didn't look at him once because my character hated him. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to have a donut with you. I'm going to go to war. Let's go. And when they say action, I want to kill you.
You know, I can see that. Now, taking a look at some of your past performances, you have an energy each time when you start a scene. I could tell that you're going in and you are, once they go, you are like, boom, ready. And that's super important. And it's like you said, actually, when you build that toolbox and there are different methodologies that come into play, and substitution and a sort of Strasburg-y kind of style really helps me out sometimes. It all really depends. And technically speaking, we're all here because for some odd reason, we have this uncanny ability to believe in imaginary circumstances really, really hard. So much that they are our own. In the most intimate kind of way. And that's the, you know, the talents right there in the imagination. And the imagination is in the mind, and the mind is fickle. So like, what do you do in your eyes? Yeah, you have the donut at craft services. Maybe you'll be okay. But if there's a chance that that's going to screw your head up, that's going to take you out of the thing that you're about to do, then don't do it. You know, and every actor has to decide for themselves what their process is. I made some mistakes early on thinking I could phone it in. I was on this show in, we were shooting in Armenia, sort of an oppressive kind of shoot. We all got pretty sick. It was long hours and everything. And I remember it was like, there was one particular scene we were doing. It was like a group scene, you know, the kind of scene where seven people all chime in at different parts. It's usually the most disengaged acting that ever happens. Yeah. Right. It was one of those. And I remember thinking, you know, it's 4 a.m. We had just gotten the sides like the night before and everything. And I really just said, you know, Mike, maybe your talent will just get you there. And I did it. And I went back and watched this show that I'm so thankful that not many people did watch this show. And I realized, nope, Mike, you, I know you've heard about other actors totally winging it, not giving a shit, and doing the scene and seeing what comes. It didn't work for you this time. You didn't give a shit, and it showed. And that was it was one of those important lessons that I think I needed. And, you know, Matthew McConaughey kind of talks about, he was somebody who, I don't know if you had read his book, Green Lights. You know, yeah, a lot of the actors out here in LA, you know, a lot of people read that for some motivation, even though he was a fellow that just kind of showed up and things worked out for him pretty damn quick. Maybe feeling a little resentful about that, but neither here nor there. He talks about this idea of freedom on set and how he really loved this idea that he doesn't need to read the script. He doesn't need to really think too hard about it. He's going to show up there and just be completely free and listen. And of course, like, he did that on a movie, and it turned out that the sides, had he decided to read them, were actually in Spanish, and he had no idea. And 15 minutes beforehand, he's taking a look or whatever. But he goes on to sort of build this philosophy that actually extraordinary preparation, a foundation that is strong and steadfast, allows you to have freedom on set. If you build something that can't easily be knocked down, that you could hold on to, you can experiment from there. And that's, look, Stanislavski said it and named his book after it, right?
An actor prepares.
That's right. They do, and for a good reason. And look, God willing, look, we all know as actors, like, we are all seeking that click when we're on set that happens for us sometimes, where we are so in the zone.
Magic time.
All the choices are being made for you. Every choice that's happening, you don't give a shit. You know that you're in the zone of making the most compelling choice for the story, for the character, and for what's in front of you. And we all do our best to prepare for that to happen. We can't exactly control it, but when it does happen, and sometimes it happens in the audition room, and that's when you're golden. That's when that whole, when they say, you know, the old knock down the door with your charisma kind of stuff, when most of the time we're a bunch of nervous messes kind of going into the deal, right? I think every actor has to figure out what is their equation for getting there. And I'm guessing that equation changes all the time, right? There's no one recipe for what we do, but how is it that we align this ability to believe in these imaginary circumstances and enter a scene and have something magical happen? You know, it's one of the great mysteries.
But, you know, the key word that you said there was preparation. You know, if you fail, I tell my actors all the time, if you fail to prepare, you've prepared to fail. And if you go into an audition and you're not prepared, that's when the nerves kick in. That's when the shit happens, because you're not prepared. How do you deal with that, the nerves, the audition nerves?
Look, in this age of self-taping, luckily, we have the ability to really curate this whole process, right? We all know that auditioning is an art in and of itself, right? And we're trying to be empathetic of the other side of the director and the casting director and kind of sort of visualize what is it that they want and maybe try to achieve that. Or we're trying to avoid the pitfalls of reading a character description, seeing a bunch of adjectives and trying to play adjectives only. We know that doesn't exactly work. You know, we put out a casting in Los Angeles for a male in his 20s or 30s, and he's cool, charismatic, and charming, and watch how interesting the auditions are. Not very. But with the self-taping, we have this ability to flesh it out and really only submit something that we think is bookable. Now, knowing if something is bookable, of course, that's a whole art trick in and of itself. What I love about auditioning in this era with the tape, and of course, there's positives and negatives. Of course, we want to get to know the casting directors. We want to get to see the people in the room. We want the people to feel our energy. And, you know, does that always translate, you know, in self-tapes? Maybe not. I mean, maybe you got a couple seconds during your slate to show you. And we don't typically do that because we're doing a slate. We're trying to like follow all the rules and pan down to a body shot and lie about being a local hire somewhere. I don't know. We all do it now. But basically, the way I do my kind of auditions now is I will do them and I'll continue to do them until I have something where I feel like I've made a compelling case that I should play this character, that they should hire me. Auditioning went from this whole, from going into the room, it was this whole buildup and trying to prepare and trying to do all these things and all confounding into one explosive moment that we typically don't even remember, right? Well, hopefully, you know, a lot of times when you do something good, you don't remember it because you're seeing red, because you're thinking the thoughts of your character and not your own self-conscious mm-hmm. bad actor thoughts, right? But now I have this whole kind of journey when an audition comes where the audition comes in, I have the sides, I start working them, and then I start putting it on its feet. And I really start kind of playing with it to see what plays, to see. Usually I know I'll feel it, but I get to try all these different choices. A lot of times I don't go in there having made a choice, but I've sort of trained, I've trained myself to take the liberty to make different choices on different takes. And sometimes that really frees things up. And then of course, you know, you do something that really works and then you try to do it again and perfect it. And it's never as good as the first time. But to go back to your original question, look, that's just another form of energy that you can transfer, that you can transfer into your character. That's, you don't want to waste any energy that's ever happening with you. You want to harvest and control that energy. Obviously, nerves is an energy that you feel like you can control, but there is a way to, it goes back to what I said, you know, that you do, that I see you as an actor when I was watching some of your work, is you explode into a scene. You go in there and it's like, you can take any of that nervous energy and give yourself a reason to propel you into that scene. Give yourself a reason that's just going to throw you right in there. And I think that's also important to do because, like, you have to start making a compelling case seconds into that audition.
Especially now. No,
yeah. Big
time.
You've
loaded up your previous circumstance. You better know where you're coming from. What happened?
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And I got this kind of kitschy thing that I do now where I really, and maybe I think this is not something you were originally supposed to do, but it helps me. I really get into the character for these auditions. I do a lot of Westerns. And I'm sorry, but I need that dirt, that sweat, and that oil, the suspenders and the ripped Henley or whatever. I do a lot of these kind of bandity kind of guys and everything. When that kind of comes on, it's like something else completely takes over.
Absolutely.
And this version of Mike, which I stole from Dexter, but I call him my dark passenger. When my dark passenger takes over, he's not worried about how people are judging him. Doesn't matter.
Love it. Love that. Love that. You know, that I think you, that's it, man. Listen, I don't want to be an actor in an audition. I want to be the character in the given circumstance. I want to step into the shoes of the character. How does that character walk? How does he talk? You know, maybe there's an animal. I'm doing an animal. Maybe he's a gorilla, the way he moves. Maybe a voice comes from it, an accent. You know, once I step into the wardrobe, you know, the shoes of the character. I mean, you've all played cowboys, right? You step into cowboy boots. It's like walking in high heels, man. You put on some Wranglers on. All of a sudden, you got a new walk because it's not what you wear. It's your character's clothes. I think it's all about that because it frees you up as an actor because it's not you. It's the character. Yeah. And the character can do whatever you want. And I love that you created an alter ego, right? Because that's what it is. It's an alter ego that shows up. It's showtime, right? You know, it's showtime. I'm stepping into this alter ego and it's playtime. I'm going to just play. And if you stay in play, then the magic happens. Because if you're in your head, you're dead. If you're in the character in the moment and you've substituted, you're personalized and you got the hair, the makeup, the wardrobe, the whole thing, and you're in play mode, anybody watching that is going to be like attracted to you because you're in play. It's a different vibration than if you're in your head and you're thinking, oh shit, because you're not in play anymore. You're in your head. So it's really creating a character, stepping into the shoes of the character, freeing yourself up. When I audition in person, I would never bring Billy Gallo into the fucking room. They don't want to meet me. They want to meet the guy, the character, you know, the cop, the criminal, this, you know, whatever it is, that's the guy I'm bringing in. I'm walking him into the door. I'm not like, hey guys, Billy, you're, you know, no, that's not who's showing up. And that frees you up. If you're super prepared and you've outworked and out prepped and out choice all the other actors and you've made all these fun choices and you're playing and you loaded it up and you're coming in as a character, you're golden. And it's not even about going to get the job. It's about having fun, man. Playing. You already got the part. You have an audience. It's showtime. Go play. And if you can do that and you can leave a piece of your soul behind in that room, they'll remember you and they'll become a fan of your work and they'll keep bringing you back in over and over and over again. If you're not right for this role, then the next one, the next one, the next one. It's about making fans in this town.
It sure is. And look, you know, it's like you have to remember that, like, we psych ourselves out when the audition comes, but it's like, this is the opportunity. You want to sit around, smoke weed, watch Tarantino movies and like eat pizza or whatever. But like when the audition comes, and this is why you are here, Look, mm-hmm. I tell everybody, you're like, oh, you know, it's like, I was looking like, and you got to beat out all these other people. Then, you know, a co-star gets 10,000 submissions and then they only look at 800 of them. And then you got to beat out 800 of them. And then you got to do this or that. And I tell people this all the time. I'm like, literally, just by giving a shit, you can beat out 95% of everyone else. That other 5%, something special better have. You got to create that magic. And, you know, you do whatever it is that you got to do and you're not going to win them all. And God help me, like, who knows what my ratio is, what anyone's ratio of audition to booking is. But yeah, you got to keep doing it and you got to keep playing around. And when the good stuff happens, it's generally because it's a mixture between the preparation, something unique that you were able to bring to that character, and really kind of seizing the moment. And do I know how to book every audition? No, but do I know how to make sure that I'm going to at least be a wild card choice? That's what I always kind of, because I'm a big choices guy, right? Because I really love taking the character description, looking at it for like half a second, and then never paying attention to it ever again. The character mm-hmm. description sometimes is written by breakdown services or but look at that script, because we get this adrenaline pumping. The audition comes in, we want to memorize it, and we want to mark it with some Atlantic Theater kind of stuff, with an intention or an objective or something like that, and get all analytical really quickly. It's also, sometimes it'll serve you to remember that you are a storyteller and this is a story. Take your time, take a look at that script and really unlock what's in there. And I find that when I take the time to do that, that's when my instincts kick in the audition room, when I'm fleshing out tapes of interesting choices. And every single time I'm on set, almost every time when the casting director's there or a producer or something, they're like, yeah, man, you know, we chose you because in this particular moment, you did this thing that no one else did. And I don't advocate for people to just make a wild choice for the sake of doing so. It has to be smartly a part of the story, something that's compelling, that's a part of the story based upon what you know in this little chunk of the sides. I mean, hopefully, whenever you get access to the whole script, of course, that's optimal. It doesn't happen very much anymore. But like, what I'll always do, and this was a big Stanislavski thing, the father of it all, I'll try to find something that alludes to the past and then really try to fill that with something. Everyone kind of asks you about what your methodology is, and it's a little hard for me to kind of explain to people, but this one method always works in an audition. Always. I mean, I tell you, something always happens. A magic moment happens when you find a key to the past. So let's just say, like, there's the scene, and in that scene, I say, oh yeah, that reminds me of that time when we tried to rob that liquor store, right? And I could say that in a good line read, right? Maybe in the context of the scene, it's just two buddies talking, hashing out memories. Oh yeah, like the time we tried to rob that liquor store, you know? But what if I decided to fill that with a vivid and unique memory? The time when me and Billy tried to rob the liquor store, we went in with guns. We forgot to load them. All of a sudden, a clown comes in and starts beating you over the head with a bat. And then a midget comes and vomits on the floor and you slip in it and you knock over the soda machine and it's flowing all over the place. And all of a sudden the cops show up, and then this hooker comes in and pulls the cop's pants down, and we run and we get away. And now when I say, yeah, like that time when we tried to rob the liquor store, it is filled with sure. everything that I just felt and saw. In a quick kind of context, if I need to ensure that interesting moments are filled, I will look for things that give me clues to the past. Okay. And I will try to fill them with like a vivid kind of past. And that's kind of like, I think it's always smart to do, because anytime we say something, it is filled with our past and our Absolutely. Experience. But if there is something that so blatantly gives you the opportunity to create an absolute memory, maybe the memory doesn't have to be as weird as how I just described it.
Sure. Well, that's going to give you something to play. I mean, you're going to laugh. You're going to think back at that memory and go, oh, yeah, the clown and the, remember when I slipped on the thing, you know?
Yeah.
I love that. Dissecting that script, right? Or those sides, you know, because you may not have a full script, and really looking for the clues. Like, why did the writer write the scene? What's the scene about? What am I supposed to make them feel? And I've used this thing for, I can't tell you how many roles I've landed, because I just use this one little thing. Like, what am I supposed to make them feel? And I learned it on my very first audition in Hollywood that I booked. I landed a guest starring role on The Fall Guy opposite Lee Majors. But the, you know, when I came into the room, right, it was a bunch of, you know, it was a guest star. It was the character's name was Billy. He was a street kid, you know, bullying these kids to deal drugs. And I come first audition in Hollywood. And I walk into the lobby and there's all those guys with the leather jackets trying to look like tough guys or whatever. And I literally had a diamond pinky ring that said Billy on it. So I put my fist in every one of their faces and I said, "What does that say? Billy, that's me. You can go home." After I told everybody to go home, I got into the room with the casting director. And the scene was, I'm threatening this kid. Let me tell you something about me. I'm either going to be your friend or your enemy. So it's up to you. And remember, your bodyguard's not around to protect you, right? But I didn't know any better. So I reached over and I grabbed the casting director and I pulled her out of the chair and I pulled her right up to me. And as I'm spewing saliva and I'm like, you know, threatening her life, she said, "Time out, time out, time out." She goes, "Number one," she goes, "Never, never, ever, ever put your hands on a casting director ever again." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. It's my first audition. You know, I didn't know." And she goes, "Number two," she goes, "you're not leaving town, are you?" And I go, "No, why?" "It's because you got the part." So I literally walked out into the lobby and I told all the guys, "Go home. I got the part." You know, she told me I got the part. Now, you never want to do any of those things. You never want to get into a confrontation with an actor. You never want to touch a casting director. But I asked that casting director why she gave me the part. You know, we were at a little party and I asked her, "Why'd you give me the part?" She said, "You scared the crap out of me, kid." Well, what was the given circumstance in the scene was I was a bully trying to put fear into this other kid. And if he didn't do what I said, I was going to beat the shit out of him. So yeah. The light bulb went off. That's how I got my SAG card. And I was in the game, right? I've applied that to every audition that I've ever go in on. You know, I'll give you another perfect example. I did a movie called Crash, okay? Bobby Maresco. My scene is I pull over Terrence Howard's character. I play an LAPD officer. I tell him, "Step out of the vehicle, get down on the ground, let me see your hands." And he's not listening to me. And I'm about to shoot this guy in the head right now. Ryan Phillippe's character stops him and says, I know this guy, you know, and we let him go, right? But I said, "What am I supposed to make him feel?" Well, they're about to get their head blown off. Well, how do I do that? I don't want to do the finger thing. All right. Get down on the ground. It's fake. It's a finger. I can't bring in a gun. Can't bring in a prop gun. Right. So I started going, how am I going to make them feel like they got a gun on them? So I had a black wallet and I brought my black wallet out like this. And I said, "Get down on the fucking ground." And I started commanding the room. This is my cell phone, but commanding the room, but using my wallet like a gun. And when I pulled out this in the room, the casting directors literally went behind the chair. And when I put my wallet away, she said, "That's the scariest wallet I've ever seen." And I said, "I knew I had that part in the room."
I got to say, you just made that phone look like a gun pretty well.
But it's, you know, it's really just,
it hand, really, you know. I know. Yeah. Your hands creating the shape. Yeah. It's amazing.
But my podcast with Bobby, he says, "Yeah, I remember what you did in the room, you know, because I know every movie poster on the wall. I know what the big choice was in the room. I know that I went and I made him feel that thing in that room." So that's what I use all the time. I dissect that script and I go, how do I make him feel that? Right. And if I got to load it up with, you know, I love what you said about creating that backstory, but, you know, that those childhood memories, right? You know, creating that, you know, writing a bio for your character, backstory for your character, know everything there is to know about your character. Because like you said, this, it's very competitive, but I would say 90% of actors are friggin' lazy. They're just trying to memorize the words on the page and survive the audition. But if you outwork them and out prep them and out choice them and you know your character, you know their deepest, darkest secrets, you know everything there is to know about your character, then, and once again, you throw that all away and in the room, you're just in the moment, but you brought a character and you have this, you know the character better than the writer who wrote it because they didn't write that. You did. You did a private moment exercise. You know what your character did last night. You know what they have in their pockets because you put it in their pockets last night in a private moment exercise. The casting directors think they know what they want, but your job is to change their mind.
Absolutely. And I think there is also, when you're an actor, you also have the responsibility to really absorb content and understand stories in general and be a fan of riveting stories so that you know how to make the most compelling choice possible. And I fell into that. I've typically kind of played against type most of my career. It ended up being a lot of these antagonists until now, but not so much of these kind of more typical protagonists or leading men or anything like that. So I would get an audition for some very bad human being. And look, I could sit there and understand the reality that the other people getting the audition for this role are 6'5", they're huge, or they have face tattoos, or they're terrifying. So I always really, in order to make that material work for me, I had to create a different version of the bad guy that worked for me. And that was usually by making them unhinged, unpredictable, or honestly, sad in a lot of ways. Because I had the opportunity a couple of years ago to play this character who, unfortunately, it was some rough stuff. It was based off a true story, and he molested his kids. And it was this really intense kind of project. And I just knew, like, when that audition came in, I was like, oh man, I'm not going to get this thing. There's all kinds of burly, weird, creepy kind of dudes who look deranged and who are going to be the unhinged antagonist that this story is calling for. So I really had to dig deep with the choices to make a compelling argument that I should be this guy. Honestly, I was doing the audition with my fiance. She was my girlfriend at the time. We studied under the same guy in New York. And she had really, she had put this thing in my head, just like how my acting coach in New York would have. She made me answer this kind of question for myself of, was this scene where I'm chasing the kids and they're trying to run away, and they do run away in the true story that happened. And instead of being angry, actors default onto anger all the time. It's the easiest kind of emotion to sort of bullshit your way through. But anger is a byproduct of pain and sadness and sometimes extraordinary pain. And so in the middle of this scene, she had put this idea in my head that I was never going to see my daughter again. And I do this like vicious, the scene that's written where he's like this vicious, terrifying, terrifying human being. Whenever my mom watches this thing or anywhere, they're like, dude, this is, I don't know who that was up there on the screen. That wasn't you. But in the audition, I thought about what she had told me when she had put this question into my head. And in the middle of this angry scene where I'm this terrifying monster of a beast coming at my children, I start dry heave crying because I can't handle, because in that moment when I'm this character right now, I had decided in that moment there was a part of him that was watching what he was doing but couldn't control it. Of course, I later find out that that's a common symptom of humans who are behaving badly. There is a part of them that is helplessly watching, wishing they would stop. And I found the scene out of nowhere to be so completely, like, utterly tragic. However it is, it translated. I ended up booking the part. It ended up being one of the most incredible experiences.
What's the name of the film? I want to watch it.
So this is called Hard to Place. And they shot the movie 6 months after the thing had happened. The Christ and Youth Foundation, the Boys and Girls Club of America, put the story together really quickly because there was these two kids who had run away from home and they lived out in the woods for like 2 weeks as they were trying to escape their abusive father. This was in Glasgow, Kentucky. There's a cartel hub, so there's a crystal meth problem, which sort of, whenever that kind of happens, basically the foster care systems get overblown because once a mom or a dad starts doing crystal meth, they can't be parents anymore. Just basically how it works. There's little epidemics all across America in these places where meth gets out of control. And so this was something unfortunate that happened. The kids were so young. And after they had escaped their abusive father and lived in the woods for 2 weeks, the foster care system couldn't even put them in the same home because it was so overblown. They were forced to like split up. So the Brothers and Sisters Club of America like came together and put financing for this short film really quickly. This was pretty early on in my career out in LA. When I'd come back into it, ended up just being, we shot, the human being that I was playing was still living in the town while we were shooting there. And before the movie came out, before he could be indicted, he ran away to Thailand. He's still over there. But wow. Yeah.
You ever have problems shaking the character, you know, holding on to some of these characters that you've created?
You know what I did on this one? So I guess according to the real story, the dad didn't start abusing his kids until the mom died. And apparently before that, they were a picture perfect family. And when the mom died, it was something they all knew was coming. I don't know that I have the details. I'm guessing it was something like cancer. After the mom died, he may have gotten involved with some drugs and started sexually abusing his kids, particularly his 6-year-old daughter. So I had that information. And with that information, I guess I decided to create all these memories of what it was like before my wife had died, before the mom had died. And they were filled with so much love. And I had this, and this is what really, this is what drove the whole thing on set on the day, because I didn't want to visualize or create child molestation in my mind. I just didn't feel like I wanted to do that. I could play pretend in my mind to believe in the circumstances as much as I needed to in the moment. But what I relied on was these scenes that I created with my wife, promising her that when she died, I was going to take care of the kids. It was, she like literally was like, that was all that she wanted. And then she could be like, then she could let go and die. So I thought about those moments when I was doing these terrible kind of acts of how I was betraying my dead wife. And I was focusing so much on the love of it that it caused utter heartbreak in the moment that manifested itself in supreme anger, supreme remorse all at the same time. And all these emotions came in, and whatever emotional cocktail decided to present itself on the day I'm to take, I didn't give a shit. I believed in my circumstances so hard that every single time we did it, and look, I worked with two extraordinary young actors, 6 and 8 years old, out in the middle on the ground there in Kentucky. And it was like, it was one of the most rewarding experiences. I had, you know, from the age of 20 to 30, I left acting completely, and I moved out of the country for 10 years.
Where'd you go?
I was in Israel for a while, New Zealand, a lot of time in Southeast Asia. I was in Turkey. I got into this whole thing where I started selling wine. I was like a beverage consultant, food and beverage consultant. And I moved out to Hollywood too young, and I just decided I was done. I was never going back. And I just wanted to travel. And I wrote a book. And I got super involved. The creativity flowed into wine.
So you gave it up for how many years?
10.
So you gave it up for 10 years. You took a break from it for 10 years and you came back to it. And now you're working, booking stuff. You just had a huge part with a Richard Linklater film, right?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I was done for 10 years. I moved back to New York when I was 30. And yeah, I've been back in the game for 7 years. And it's been, 50. I think I did 10 projects before I left, and 50 in the last 7 years. It's been like a lot different this time around.
And so what's the difference?
I don't know, man. I spent a lot of years, thousands of miles away from anybody who cared if I lived or died. I saw the world, and I got to try and do other things. And something about learning other crafts has widened me.
Makes you a better actor.
Yeah. I mean, I think seeing the world in and of itself helps, and seeing other contexts. But I mean, I was accidentally a part of like two revolutions. I feel all kinds of funny, crazy stuff. That's a whole other unpacking or whatever. But I think a lot of that experience is still marinating. But when I came back into the game, I had something to say. I had no fear, zero fucks. When I was really alone, man, I found that stories and fictional characters motivated me so greatly, so greatly. Storytelling is something that is so incredibly important to me, so much so that, like, even when I go in to play a character, I really start with the story first. I really start with the situation, and then the character kind of, you know, I always seek to serve the story, and then I find out how that character best serves that story. I've made the pitfall before about really, really focusing on character so much that I don't actually have the context of the story in mind. And as somebody who loves stories, who has a good ability to see themselves in a crowd, I really found myself always seeking to enhance the story with my character, really finding where their place is. And I found a home for a long time with antagonists. And I couldn't figure out why. Originally, I'm a pretty pleasant guy. I look like maybe somebody who shouldn't be an antagonist or something. But I think I find that I empathize with other people's faults. And why is it that characters behave badly? The genesis of that usually is some kind of pain. Maybe it's a cycle of abuse or something like that, or a mistake. And I've made so many of those. And I really, you know, it's the famous phrase, like, every villain is the hero of their own story. And for a while there, I really loved justifying what my antagonists were doing.
Yeah, and bad guys don't think they're bad guys.
Yeah, and we live in an age now where we're actually focusing more on the anti-hero and the imperfect human being. It's not that typical kind of happy-go-lucky Michael J. Fox protagonist bopping around and being lovable or whatever. No, we've got a lot of really real, visceral human beings really fucking up, and the audience loving them for it. Because we all, listen, we go out our door there, and we know that that's a world out there that's filled with challenge, pain, and suffering. It's also filled with tremendous and incredible love, too. But we know that, like, life is really, really difficult. None of us are perfect. And stories these days are really reflecting the subtle nuances of our own human journey that we take, which inevitably is filled with pain. And this art of us seeking happiness. And the one thing that I learned in my travels and coming back to this whole thing is that happiness doesn't interest me. A purpose fulfilled interests me. And I think I'm still kind of finding that as an actor and as an artist. And maybe along the way during COVID, I did a lot of maybe not so great kind of movies and everything, because I just wanted to work and not always doing like the most, you know, incredible stuff. But of course, now it's starting to really hone in. And working with Richard Linklater and Glenn was obviously a pretty pinnacle kind of experience. But it also because it was just one of those, it was one of those things where Linklater writes these extremely long scenes, Before Sunrise and those Ethan Hawke ones, or Boyhood and yeah, some of those other movies. And, you know, with the scene that we have, it's like something like 9 pages long dialogue scene between me and Glenn, right?
Wow.
But the funny thing is like when scenes are that long, you have no choice but to be like living in the world of that the whole time, right? Your ability to live and be in that scene and make choices, there's no getting out of it. You're in it, and that's it. And I just loved it. And he did something. He did this thing that opened up my world tremendously. During the callback for this, he actually had me improvising quite a lot, which I'd say is my general kind of comfort zone for feeling my way into a character. I'll even use that as a methodology while I'm preparing. But on set, every time we did a take, it was 17 minutes. We shot all day, right? On this one particular scene that was really long. But what he does is after he's gotten all of his coverage, he'll shoot a series where of your close-up where you make the rules. It's your show. You start and stop that camera, whatever you want. You say whatever you damn well please. You can ask the character, the actor across from you, to say your line again. And first, obviously, they started with Glenn Powell's coverage. You know, he's the star or whatever. And I saw them do that for his. And then they swung on to me or whatever. And we did this take. And man, when I was given the permission, we had done this scene like so many times by now too, full coverage or whatever, that felt like doesn't so in the scene. So everything's already kind of there and automatic. But when he said that I could say whatever I wanted, there was no rules. He got everything he needed. He loves what he's got, right? I think it's what he said, right? Mm-hmm. Everything meticulously to take any pressure off you, right? And during this scene, man, the things that came out of my fucking mouth, how alive I felt. And I barely remember it, but I knew the Dark Passenger had taken over completely. And no director had ever given me this before, right? Like they've never given me that kind of freedom, especially in these circumstances. Like Jason Bateman's producing, Richard Linklater, I got this guy across me who's probably like the biggest rising star in Hollywood right now. Like there's a lot of different ways to be nervous or whatever. And I just sandblasted this thing with fuck it. And I felt so in character. And I always had these other thoughts that I was too nervous to maybe kind of bring out because I wanted to fall under the direction and everything. We do this like 17-minute take that I can't remember jack shit from other than just knowing and feeling like so completely alive. We finish the take and Glenn leans into me and he's like, Mike, look over there. And I was like, what? He's like, and I look over and Richard Linklater's dancing. He turns to me, he says, you just made Rick dance. That's a really good thing.
That's awesome.
And Rick comes up to me, just grabs me by the shoulders, and he's like, that was fucking awesome. Now, I haven't seen this movie yet. I played at Sundance, which I had a buddy that was there, and I played at Venice in London. And my friend started reciting these lines that I said, oh, yeah, when you said this, this, and that, I'm like, motherfucker, for my edit, they used my improv take. All these lines that they were talking about were not the ones in the script. And I was like, I knew it. I mean, I knew like the good shit was going to come from that. And I was kind of wondering about Rick while I was working with him because he was so nonchalant the whole time. he just kind of treats you like a buddy in between takes. They kind of like just come up and like shoot the shit and just kind of just sort of have this kind of conversation with you. But he's directing you. Make no mistake. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely directing you in his own kind of way. And there is this like subtle brilliance that's there that you really only, he elicits incredible performances out of people and he writes incredible, you know, incredible stories. He is not there directing you. And the closest thing I got to like any kind of typical direction was he walked up after one of the things. He's like, huh, what do you say we lower his IQ a little bit? Which I thought was a funny piece of direction to which I took, made him a little stupider or whatever. But most of the time he's just kind of, he's doing a spitball with you. Just like he wants to talk about it. Cause he knows that the way to find the truth of this scene is this kind of like very real collaboration. Anywho, it was incredible to work on a story like that. And look, when you set out to do a movie, you never know if it's going to be a good movie. And I'm just glad people seem to really like this one. And because Netflix liked it, so they bought it.
It's awesome. I can't wait to see it. I saw the trailer and I was like, oh, cool. I can't wait to see this.
Yeah, it looks fun. It looks fun. People see it.
But I love that. I love what he did is he made you one. He said, he took the pressure off. We got it. It's in the can. All right. So let's, I love when directors say that. Okay, we got it. It's in the can. Now this one's for you. Do whatever you want. Yeah, go play. And what he did is he let you play and it freed you up because the pressure was off. You know what I love that you said when you came back to the business, it was no fear, zero fucks. And I think that's the thing. That's the secret ingredient. When you come in and you're desperate and you need this job and you know, I got to get this job because I need my insurance or, you know, blah, blah, blah. When you come in to an audition, like with that desperation, it's a different energy than if you come in with like, you know what? I'm just here to play, man. I've created a compelling character and it's playtime. I'm just going to have some fucking fun in here. That's when the magic happens. I mean, that's what happened on that set. That's why he was jumping up and down is because you were in the zone. You were in play. You were having fun. You were just lost in the moment and shit was coming out. And you know, that's where the magic happens. That's the zone. That's like you try to get back to that place, like a junkie needing a fix. That's what keeps you going in this business is that those magical moments when you get lost and you go, what just happened? But you see people jumping up and down after you did what you did. And you have no clue because you were in it, lost, deep in it.
Totally. And I think what's super important to remember and something I have to remind myself is none of these incredible experiences where I feel like an incredible artist means that I'm safe right now. And I think that's cool. And I think that's why I like it. I think I like the idea that anytime you go onto set, everything hangs on the edge of a knife. And everybody should act that way and not get too comfortable. And know that like every single time you have to work to get it, right? And I know that if I hadn't been the countless hours I spent at night knowing that I'm about to do this Linklater picture and knowing that I can't fuck it up, knowing that it'll probably get to Sundance if it's good or whatever, that I had thought so much about this character that I can't take that moment when he gave me the freedom to play for granted and say, oh, cool. I don't care. This next movie. Oh yeah. Okay, cool. I'm just going to play with him. Like that time with Rick and I just did awesome. No, it was because I worked. It was because I gave a shit about this story. I gave a shit about what this scene meant in the context of the story and what my character was doing as the obstacle for this protagonist. And I thought about all those things so earnestly. Improv and wild improv and everything, it's something that I believe in and don't believe in to a certain extent. Because when I watch a scene that was clearly improv, sometimes it makes me uncomfortable because I don't see people listening. I see people trying to be funny or trying to say shit that's interesting without listening. And improv is listening. And when you have two artists who know how to do it correctly, they're not talking over each other. And these scenes organically happen in a great way. And it's not always necessary. And sometimes it's just an embellishment or a bit of freedom to build off of what's already in the script. It's not about throwing it away. But there is something at the end of the day, like when you make the words your own, whether it's improv or not, like the same thing that you try to accomplish in improv, you can accomplish in a normal script too. Because sometimes I feel like, oh, well, I guess if they let me improvise this scene, there's no way I'll be a bad actor because it's my own words and I've thought it and I'm speaking it, but I have to speak someone else's words and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then, yeah, so it's all, for me, it's been a personal thing about taking that methodology and putting it into scripted material too.
when I'm on set, I don't ask the director or, God forbid it, the writer director, hey man, I'm just going to change your words around and say what I want to say. But, you know, sometimes, you know, sometimes they're just, especially in the TV world, that you just throw that away completely. Yeah. Unless that's the format of the show. But
no, word for word, verbatim. Don't add anything. Don't change television length. Hey, so last question. Okay, I gotta teach a class right here. But if you could, you know, go and back and give yourself some advice, some life advice, right? Go back to the little you. What would it be?
I would probably say to young Mike, stay in school, try out all the things that you want to try. You're always going to be an actor, no matter how many times you try to run away from it. Go do what interests you. That's never going away. And all the new things that you learn are only going to continue to embellish you as an actor. I think the little trap that I got in as a young kid who just wanted to be an actor and got stars in his eyes, that I didn't end up paying attention in history class. And now I'm fucking obsessed with history. And now, like, I think that's like an incredible, like, to learn about World War II. And like what humanity was like during that time. That is those are high circumstances. When you do a movie or tell a story, it's almost always high circumstances. Understand what humanity was like in these kinds of times and learning other things, these things like, I'm not saying like don't go to acting class or whatever, but like you have to expand yourself as a human. That's what's going to inform your instincts. And it's those instincts on the day, like I was saying before, at hour 13 when it's freezing and wet and people suck. It's all you there. That's all you. That's all you got to rely on. Make yourself a center of strength, a foundation that can't be broken, and be the biggest, widest person that you can be. Expand yourself to be able to play and think and do anything. There's no circumstances for me now at this point in my life are too intense for me to handle. Not saying I want to go be a rapist every time or whatever, but I mean, anyway, that's the long-winded answer to my question. Learn to do other things.
Yeah, listen, everything, your life, everything out there is an acting class. You know, the good, the bad, the ugly, that all that's your gold. Okay, I lied. There's one more question. What advice do you have for actors, you know, young actors getting into this business?
Everything starts off pretty simple. Yes, there are the things that you have to do as an actor. You need something on your resume. You need proof of it. You need an agent. So how do you get all those things? You need to get online, get on Backstage, get wherever the hell you can to find auditions. There's always student films going on everywhere in the country, everywhere in the world. Do it. I'm not saying it has to be like me where it's like I'm an experiential learner where I just needed to work and work and work in order to kind of figure out my process and figure out my method, but do whatever it is. There's enough resources out there to get working. Even if you're working for free for a student film. What I used to do is I used to take the train in Chicago to the Columbia College Film School. And there was a little board that had all these auditions for the film school for their student films. And I went and I tried out different versions of acting. I wanted to try other characters, other things. There is, if you wanted to, if you're in Los Angeles, New York, or Chicago, you could find a way to be in a movie every single day. And I tell this to people and, you know, get on Backstage. Backstage, Actors Access 2, sure, Casting Networks, that's annoying, but get on Backstage where it's essentially free to upload. You could take a picture with your iPhone and edit it to look like a headshot. I think I use that for my headshots sometimes too. There's an easy barrier to entry now. Get online, find the movie auditions that don't pay at first. Or, hey, go for the Penguins too. I'm not saying they'll do that, but I find when I came back into the industry, I got on Backstage and I just started doing student film after student film. I was like an old car that needs to get back on the road. I had been 10 years. I don't know what the hell I was doing. I just knew I just wanted to start doing it. I was in acting class trying stuff out. That's another thing though. Get into an acting class, but just make sure you find the right guy and just know that there's no one recipe and just know that at the end of the day, it's your own unique brand that you're bringing and take what works for you and leave what doesn't. But I'll say this one more time, get on Backstage. You can act every single day. There is 50 student films casting on Backstage every single day. Do it. Get on there, audition, 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 and just start doing it. Because I talk to people, so many people out here, people I moved out here with or had known or whatever. No one's doing anything. I'm like, don't, if you want to be an actor, don't you want to be acting? Yes, I understand that you're a waiter right now for sure. But you know that there's like, there's always something shooting and you can do both and you have to be able to do both. You have to be able to, yes, you can support yourself and still be working, because one of these student films that I did gave me the most incredible scene I had ever acted in my life and got me an agent. And they still use that scene to this day. Was some crappy little non-paying thing that I did that was shot beautifully by a kid now who's now like, he's pretty huge, and ended up being the most value. It was a non-paying job that paid me the most, because now I don't need to work a day job or something, because I've built a career, and that was a stepping stone. Get the footage, do the work. That's it.
Love that. Great advice. Mike, I can't thank you enough for jumping on the podcast and sharing your wisdom and knowledge with the listeners out there. So if people want to like connect with you and follow you, what are your like handles, social media and stuff?
Yeah, just Mike Markoff on Instagram or Facebook and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes if I'm allowed to on YouTube, I post some of my audition tapes, usually the ones that turn into bookings, just because I like to. One, I think they're fun to pitch with sometimes too, if I ever want my reps to pitch me for something specific. Also, because you do an audition, you don't want it to just stay in audition land. If you did something good, maybe it lives out in perpetuity. And I break a lot of rules in my audition. So if you do watch them, they're usually ones that I booked. And if you need a little motivation or a little help, you can always reach out to me. No one understands the struggle better. No one understands the mind fuck as much as I do, because this is all a tough road that we're on. But we're here to fight the good fight. And we have to wake up every single day knowing it's in a fight. The big difference is if you enter that fight with your head held high. I think that's it.
Amen. When's Hitman come out on Netflix?
June 6th. And it'll be in theaters, I think, 2 to 3 weeks beforehand.
Awesome. Can't wait to see it, brother.
Me too. And yeah, I haven't seen it either. I'm pretty curious. So,
Mike, take care, bro.
All right, buddy. You too.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. Please rate, review, share this with your friends. Subscribe if you haven't. Please take whatever you get from here, the golden nuggets, and apply them to your career. Go after your dreams with passion. Don't let anybody tell you it can't be done. I believe in you. Follow your dreams. I'll see you in Hollywood.